Thank you, Dr. Marsman. Are we done? I think that the serious problems of the cities come in two versions. One I will call the normal class version, the other the lower class version. Take employment, for example, the problem of, perhaps I'd better call it the problem of unemployment and underemployment. The normal class version is essentially one of young people entering the labor market, getting their first job. It's also, to some extent, a problem of turnover. The lower class version of the unemployment problem arises from the fact that some people prefer the action of the street to work and to the discipline of a job and a regular way of life. Poverty, the same story. The normal class version consists largely of old people, physically handicapped people, and to some extent, women with children to support. The lower class version, on the other hand, consists of people who would be, in some sense, poor. That is, they would show the familiar symptoms of poverty, but not because they lack money, or at least not simply for that reason. They would be poor in this sense, even if their incomes were doubled or tripled. Their poverty is really a style of life. Crime, again, the normal class version, consists largely of stealing by boys. Stealing by boys accounts for a very large percentage of all reported crimes in this country. The lower class version, on the other hand, consists of violence, muggings, and the like. Schools, well, we could go down the list, and I think show you that there's a normal and a lower class version of each problem. Now, the normal class form of the problem is, in a quantitative sense, the more conspicuous, the more important. There are really very few hardcore unemployed as compared to the very large number, relatively, of young people entering the labor market and people moving from one job to another. Again, there are very few so-called problem families in the welfare roles. Most people on welfare are simply old, physically handicapped, and so on. The lower class version of the problem is qualitatively a far more important one, in my view. It is this that causes the crisis, if there is a crisis. It's this that is the persistent, recalcitrant, intractable problem. In fact, I think if the normal class problem were to disappear, leaving the lower class problem, most of us would still feel, if we feel it now, that we have an urban crisis. Whereas if it were the other way around, if the lower class problem were to disappear, leaving the normal class problem, I don't think many of us would be talking about a crisis. And I mean not just us here, but the American public at large would not be talking about a crisis. Now, I'm afraid that the normal class problems wouldn't entirely disappear even if the libertarian utopia were established. I think if the free market were allowed to operate, it would go a great way toward alleviating the normal class problem. I think, for example, eliminating the minimum wage laws and eliminating the restrictive practices of labor unions would do an enormous amount to improve the employment conditions of many young people and others as well. Would also, incidentally, I think, have an effect on the crime problem. But even under the best of circumstances, there would be large numbers of young people entering the labor market and finding it hard to get a first job that they really liked, and there would always be a certain amount of turnover. So I think that the normal version of these problems is bound to be with us. But as I say, it doesn't seem to me to be a particularly upsetting it's not the kind of a problem that we need to fear. The essential health and welfare of the society is endangered by. The really intractable and important problem, it seems to me, lies with the lower class, which I take to be a rather small part of the whole urban population. I can't say how large a part, because the data that would enable me to do so simply don't exist, but I would say, to give you a rough idea, perhaps if we're talking about the largest central cities in the United States, somewhere around possibly 10 or 15% of the central city. Now, it's the existence and of a particular outlook and style of life that constitutes the problem here. I regard this outlook and style of life as in the term that social anthropologists describe the outlook and style of life of a society. That is a culture, more particularly a subculture. As I see it, this subculture is one in which people live from moment to moment. To use a piece of jargon, they are present-oriented rather than future-oriented. They place no value on work. They're not willing to make sacrifices of present for future satisfaction. They're not interested in self-improvement. And it's this pattern, this mentality, this culture, that gives rise to this complex of really intractable problems. The question then arises, how does one change the outlook, the culture, subculture, of the lower class? And it seems to me here the libertarians, unfortunately, have very little to rely upon. It simply is not enough to repeal the minimum wage laws, valuable as that would be with respect to the normal problem. I don't see how perfecting market arrangements, and in general leaving people free, desirable as those things are in and of themselves, I don't see how that would bring about a change in the culture of the lower class. Sociologists, I notice, come to talk like economists when they talk about the lower class. I mean by that the sociologist, who one would normally expect to talk in terms of culture and personality and so on, begins to talk in terms of incentives, opportunities, and so on. This, I suppose, is because most sociologists in the United States are liberals. They find it very difficult to believe that the fault may lie not in the environment or the system, but in the individual himself, in the culture that he bears, to be precise. They seem to think that the culture of the lower class will be discarded whenever the economic opportunities to discard it are good. That is to say, that if people are offered really good opportunities to earn, they will abandon their carefree ways. They will start living it up, enjoying life from moment to moment, and settle down to hard work. That is a very oversimplified extrapolation of the views of sociologists, say, Robert Merton, Richard Clouard, whose opportunity theory has been, for the last 10 years, a very influential one in government. Give people in the lowest income group and in the lowest cultural group good opportunities, and they will respond to them dramatically. That's the theory. Well, if you see this thing in terms of culture, and personality, you don't expect any such rapid adaptation. You expect perhaps an adaptation to opportunity, but a rather slow, hesitant, imperfect one. Culture is, I think, highly analogous to deeply ingrained habit. People don't change it overnight because it would be, in some sense, rational at the moment to do so. For one who takes this view that I am offering you then, the what you could call a culture hyphen personality view of the matter, the tendency is to fall back on, as a prescription, to fall back on measures to socialize the child into normal culture, to teach him the ways of the normal style of life at a very early age, which I'm afraid is the only time you can teach him. And this means emphasize a radically different style of education in his early years, in his most formative years, and possibly, because no one knows for sure, the experiments that have been made so far have not been very reassuring, possibly take him from his children, from his parents, take him as a child from his parents in infancy, or very soon after infancy, and bring him up out of the culture of the lower class in the culture of normal society. A very radical prescription indeed from any viewpoint, certainly from the viewpoint of libertarians. Are you going to follow the practice of knocking on this? When are you going to knock? I
have to wait till my knock.
Well,
I'm knocking.
No, I know, but I have another maybe 10 minutes that I could. Is that all right? I thought I would like to offer you some empirical evidence on these matters that have come to my attention. I'd like to keep you my listeners up to date, and keeping up to date means, in this case, keeping you up to March 31st, 1970, which is the date of a report that's just come to my attention, a study of successful persons from seriously disadvantaged backgrounds. This is the final report prepared for the Office of Special Manpower Programs, Department of Labor, Washington. Principal investigator Harvey L. Ross, Ph.D. I don't know, but he had the kindness to send me this because he thought I'd be interested in it, as I am. Human Interaction Institute, Research Institute, Los Angeles. Ross and his colleagues have taken two groups of males, aged 21 to 30, who grew up in large city ghettos. These were families, all of them from families on welfare or in public housing. Now, if a subject remembered almost always having had enough to eat and wear as a child, he was not qualified for the sample. About half the sample are black, the other half are Mexican-American. 32 of approximately half of the sample were successful. The others, the controls, were unsuccessful. The successful ones had made it, as the author puts it. And they're defined as follows. They're people who worked more or less steadily for the last 2 years, or had been going to school, had not received welfare, did not require Department of Labor help for training or to get a job, and were not in trouble with the law. These are the successful ones. Now, the unsuccessful, 38 individuals, unemployed or underemployed for the past 2 years, would need the intervention of a public agency to prepare them for a job. The researchers had long interviews with these people, inquiring into matters that, on the basis of sociological literature, seemed to them to be related to mobility. For example, and this is only a few items of a long list, they inquired into this individual's sense of self, his alienation, or lack of it, as the case might be, his awareness of alternative paths that were open to him, occupationally and otherwise, his risk-taking capacity, job history, language, and so on. Let me give you a sample of the kinds of questions that they asked in the interview. When you're not working, how do you like to pass the time? What do you do? What would you like to do with your life 10 years from now? When you were growing up, how did your father or mother feel about staying off welfare? Now, these items were statistically were sorted out according to whether or not they seem to be statistically significant as between the two groups. I can't speak of the adequacy of the statistical operation because I don't know anything about statistics, but you, if you're interested, can look into that. They found, incidentally, that there was no difference in intelligence using the SRA nonverbal test between the successful and the unsuccessful people. But they found many very striking differences in their style of life and in the kinds of responses that they made generally. I know my time is short, so I'm going to give you a sample. I'll just give you a quick impression of this. The study treats the Mexicans and the blacks separately, but then it lumps them together. For simplicity's sake and brevity's sake, I'm treating the two lumped together rather than separating them out. They found 34 items differentiating A's from B's, that is, successfuls from non-successfuls, in the two ethnic groups together. Taking the Mexicans separately, there were 16 more such items, and taking the blacks separately, there were 49 more. So the numbers are considerable. Here's an example. Home atmosphere described as warm. That's a successful group. I'll start with the successful. Home atmosphere described as warm, unsuccessful, neutral, or hostile. The subject now contacts parental family frequently or occasionally, successful, and with a non-successful, rarely or never. Successful, now most alienated from father, unsuccessful, now most alienated from mother or siblings. Successful participated in school activities, unsuccessful did not participate, and so on through 34 items for the two, and as I said, more for the others. Now, they find a pattern here in these responses. I can't take the time to give you the outlines of the pattern, except to say that it coincides very well with what sociologists have described as a lower class and a normal class style of life. And I'm going to summarize some of the most pertinent features of it. Two styles are described. Mainstream life in its ghetto variant, characterized by a work and achievement ethic, close family ties and loyalties, avoidance of trouble with the law, stability on the job, taking responsibility for one's own destiny, orderly planning for long-range goals, the ability to sustain activity and goal-directed behavior, and an ability to make a somewhat harmonious adjustment to the existing larger social order. The other contrasting style, street life or gang life, characterized by an ethic of toughness, shrewdness, hustling, violence, an emphasis on having a reputation among one's peers, a lessened concern with family responsibility and ties than with ties to peers, glorification of antisocial acts in the mainstream sense, and the absence of long-range planning or goal-seeking in favor of immediate gratification, all combined with a rejection of most mainstream values. Well, now we find that once a boy has started in one direction, he tends to continue in that direction. You don't have a mixture of these two subcultures. The young man is differentiated and separated out into one or the other, and then his further development is along those lines. So the question then arises, how do they get differentiated into one or the other of these two subcultures, both of which are found in the ghetto? Well, the answer is, according to this study, which is based, of course, on a rather small sample, an effective parent. An effective parent. Walter Burns, you'll be pleased to hear, an effective parent. And an effective parent, it turns out, is one able to extend conditional love, meaning that when a child misbehaves, it's not rejected, but it is made to feel that it gets less reward of some kind, less love, if you like, from the parent or the parent surrogate than it otherwise would have got. Now, the sex of the parent with whom the child grows up is not very important, it turns out. Not very important in and of itself. But Pat Moynihan will be distressed to learn this if he hasn't already learned it. But, and here he might take some comfort, among Mexican Americans, only males can make demands on other males regarding standards of conduct. This is part of the machismo business, kind of a special kind of masculinity cult among the Latins, apparently. Therefore, a mother cannot be what's called in this study an assimilator. A mother in the Mexican-American culture can't be the one who disciplines the boy in a way that will assimilate him into the standards of the normal culture. Among blacks, however, both the mother and the father can impose binding demands on their sons, that is to say, are entitled to exhibit conditional love, or in more ordinary language, I suppose, to put a spank on when the occasion calls for it. And that seems to make all the difference in the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed.